Peter R. Breggin, M.D., is called the conscience of psychiatry for his many decades of successful reform efforts. His scientific and educational work provide the foundation for modern criticism of drugs and ECT, and lead the way in promoting more caring and effective therapies. His books include Talking Back to Prozac, Toxic Psychiatry, Medication Madness, Psychiatric Drug Withdrawal, and now, Guilt, Shame, and Anxiety, Understanding and Overcoming Negative Emotions. Welcome to the Dr. Peter Breggin Hour.
Hello, hello, hello. This is Dr. Peter Breggin, my wonderful audience. Glad to be in communication with you. And you know from hearing me say my wonderful, wonderful audience that this is my radio and TV show, because I don't introduce my videos by addressing the audience the way I do today. Michael Cornwall and Ken Castleman are my guests today, and we are going to be talking about electrical stimulation of the brain and the Dr. Peter Breggin Hour. Dr. Castleman is a new friend, a new collaborator, who is a most extraordinary addition to my life and to our work, because he's a PhD specialist in the field of electricity, and in particular, a lot about electrical injury. So this is an incredibly important area, and I'm just so glad. I'm learning from him every day. Not every day, but every other day, maybe, a lot of the time. And recently we've heard from Michael. He didn't know it until this moment, but he apparently got an article published, a letter to the Wall Street Journal criticizing ECT. I think he's relatively new to that field, but he was a part of the very significant team brought together that forced the Somatics Inc. to put a warning, to settle a lawsuit and to put a warning on its machine, the Thymotron, about the damaging effects of ECT. And this is a big breakthrough, and he did a report on the some of the electrical aspects and harmful effects of ECT. Today we're going to be focusing on Monarch, a much subtler thing that the FDA has approved for children for ADHD, but it opens it up to being used on any age group for anything once it's approved by the FDA, because there's no rules, no laws to prevent doctors from using anything that's approved. It's up to malpractice suits and professional organizations to control things, but in psychiatry, there's no control. That's why you can, burn a hole in the brain, you know, because in psychiatry, everything goes, and it always has. Everything has always gone there. And Michael Cornwall is the director of our organization that's done through this, our Center for the Study of Empathic Therapy, and the director of Stop the Abuse of Psychiatric Abuse of Children, SPAC. He's director of that. And he'll give you some information on how you can get directly in touch with him to talk more about how we can end this FDA approval on SPAC, what we can do to alert people. And part of what we're doing here is documenting the issues so we can understand them. Now, I want to introduce this briefly with an interesting putting together of a whole bunch of different things. I'm going to pull this down so I can look at it better. Pardon me. For those of you who will be watching this on TV, the way this works, folks, is the radio is live every Wednesday at 4 p.m. on PRN.FM, wonderful PRN.FM, the Progressive Radio Network. It goes on live 4 p.m. New York time. And then within a day or two, we get it up as the TV show. which is being recorded at the same time. Well, I was looking through a report on ECT by the Royal College of Psychiatrists, and I was really interested to see what they lump together with ECT. Well, they lump with it psychosurgery, which in more recent years has become deep brain stimulation as well, because they put an electrode in, then a series of electrodes, as many as they want, and then they stimulate them, which gives them an idea of some of the effects they're getting, so they make great notes and maybe decide to put it in a paper. It never comes out, by the way, to make a lot of useful sense. I've read a lot of psychosurgery patient papers. They're not scientists. They're meat cutters, and they do very bad work. psychosurgery hits the same areas of deep brain stimulation, which is basically anywhere in the front lobe that the surgeon likes to operate. He's usually got one area he loves and loves to go in and mutilate or stimulate, or in the limbic system, and the whole vast array of the higher mental centers, sometimes going down even a little deeper. So deep brain stimulation is what doctors are doing because I stopped them from doing psychosurgery. Very little has been done since my campaign in the 70s. But they still do some, and they all do, or a lot of them like to do deep brain stimulation. There's no evidence it helps mental disorders, and of course there's evidence it's harmful, but nonetheless it's allowed. Then another lumped together with ECT and psychosurgery and deep brain stimulation is transcranial magnetic stimulation, where an electromagnetic coil is put outside of the brain and creates a relatively small alternating and circles current. And our real expert on that will tell us more about that when we get going. Then there's vagal nerve stimulation, in which you put direct stimulation into the vagus nerve, and that's generally used for affecting the heart and the lungs and breathing. And it's well known what the connections are, unlike the stuff that the brain stimulators are doing. And it's mainly going downward, outward toward the heart, and very, very different from all these other things which are going in at the brain. Very simple explanations. You'll get nothing like this anywhere else, because the guys who know about it, they don't want to talk about it. I mean, it's not very complicated. They just don't want to talk about it. Then we get to something that begins to approach the monarch, and that's a transcranial direct current stimulation with relatively weak currents of 0.5 milliamps to 2 milliamps. That's very weak. It takes about 80 milliamps to cause a convulsion for the lower intensity ECTs. And the goal is to stimulate cortical tissue excitability. Now, why in the world anybody want to do that? And even to say it's stimulating is a misnomer. Well, it's disrupting. I mean, this stimulating and modulating, changing, there's all these words they use. They don't say causing dysfunction in. It's cortical, and those are the highest centers of the brain, and they're particularly in the prefrontal cortical area, which is exactly where you do some of the most effective, devastating lobotomies. So here they are hitting that again. So now we get to the monarch, which is called the monarch ETNS, little ETNS. It's trigeminal nerve stimulation. Electrodes are put on the outside of the head. Two of them are taped on, and they are used to stimulate the brain directly all night long. And this has been approved by the FDA. I'm going to let Michael in a minute tell you more about it. But they again are claiming to increase cortical tissue excitability. Notice all the excitement they feel, these really, they're simple-minded butchers, that they feel, these neurosurgeons and psychiatrists, about getting in there and stimulating this organ that we know nothing about practically. It's like a dark hole, no Einsteins of the brain. I mean, there's no Newton of the brain. The brain's a mystery. You get the Nobel Prize when you develop a new staining technique or learn about a bunch of new neurotransmitters, which we don't know about all of them by any means. So there's this dark, marvelous, incredible place that allows this show to go on today. I mean, the Earth can't do this. It takes a living human being. And to go in there and just stimulate it or modulate it or change it is really quite bizarre. I just want to put that in right now. And I want to ask Kenan to, for just a real brief time, talk about the Monarch device just a little bit for a few minutes in its electrical manifestations and how it may differ from some other things. And then we'll go on and hear all about the Monarch. Ken?
Yeah, this device runs a fairly small current through the scalp on the forehead, but it runs it through an area where the trigeminal nerve is located. And the trigeminal nerve contains a large number of nerve fibers that go back into the brain. So the effect of this is it stimulates those fibers to send messages back into the brain. And these are messages that normally would come from all different areas of the face and the front of the head. But when you stimulate that nerve, those messages go back into the brain, and the brain has no way to know that they didn't come from the nose, the eyes, the ears, the tongue. And so it creates a big confusion in the brain. And I think your point is well taken, that nobody can tell you what the potential benefits of bombarding a section of the brain, particularly for long periods of time, like maybe 6 or 8 hours, with random noise, basically. They just inject random noise into this nerve, it goes back into the brain, and then nobody knows what effect that has. And there haven't been any studies that I'm aware of that will tell you any connection, why there might be any connection between stimulating these areas of the brain where the trigeminal nerve goes into and behavioral problems like ADHD.
Good. And they make believe it does. They it's very interesting. They claim, I'll let Michael answer that one, what they claim about the effects on ADHD centers. Michael Cornwall, my dear friend and director of SPAC, would you, first of all, even before you start talking, would you tell people what your email is that they can get in touch with you to talk about our center and what they might do to help stop the things we're doing to children, including this transcranial nonsense? Michael?
Yes, Peter. The dedicated email for the SPAC organization is SPACvictory@outlook.com. And that's an active email. You can contact me there, and it's part of the connection with Peter's empathic therapy organization. We'd be glad to hear from anyone.
Back to the beginning, Michael. I'm just giving you the mic now and talk about the whole story of Monarch again. Not many people have heard it.
Okay, Peter. Great to meet you, Ken, and thank you so much for joining us here today. Of course, Peter comes at this from many decades of being a champion for the abuse against the abuses of adults and children. And I've read about some of your work too, and we're so grateful that you're here talking with us today. I'm kind of an old style psychotherapist who worked for almost 30 years in a public mental health system. A lot of that, decades of that, working with families, children, and teens. And so when I heard about this Monarch device, I just saw it on the internet in the spring about this FDA-approved device, the first time ever in the United States for children diagnosed with ADHD. I immediately contacted Peter about it, and we started writing articles and doing podcasts and these programs like this, but basically just for people so they can get a sense of what this is. It is an FDA-approved treatment that it's a non-replicated study. There was a brief study with a small number of children between 8 and 12 years old who had this device, as Ken said, that generates electricity through the trigeminal nerve, that's the T and ETNS, is placed over the child's forehead all night long. It's a prescription device. There's wires come down. It goes into kind of like a cell phone size battery pack. And the results of it were very questionable, especially people like Peter and I who questioned the whole diagnosis validity of ADHD anyway. But what struck me when I saw that FDA press release was the almost Madison Avenue kind of writing style that they had. And I just want to quote one line from it, that back to what you were saying, Ken, in terms of what they, the words they use to describe these effects on people. It sounds, like I say, almost like Madison Avenue. So it says that through the trigeminal nerve, it, quote, sends therapeutic signals to the parts of the brain thought to be involved in ADHD. So right there, they're claiming therapeutic signals and to the parts of the brain thought to be involved with ADHD. I mean, that sounds like almost a used car kind of pitch or something, you know?
Well, you know, from what Ken was saying, and I'm in total agreement with him, it's chaos messaging. I mean, it's really creating chaos. Is that a fair statement, Ken?
Yeah, that's right. Basically, normally that nerve carries specific messages, like from the tongue and from the eyelids and stuff, that tell the brain what's going on the front part of the head so that the brain can manage things. And then you come along and you grab that whole bundle of nerves and just run an electric current through there. The nerves just start firing and sending chaotic, random messages back into the brain. It would be like in the control center, for example, of a nuclear power plant, when all of a sudden the alarms start going off and the lights are blinking and everything. The brain does not know what to make out of those signals that are coming in. They make no sense. And over a period of time, the brain will somehow adapt to that, and who knows how the brain is going to respond to being bombarded with random signals coming in from what it thinks is the front of the head.
Well, let me say quickly just to that point. when I first read about this and Peter and I started reporting on this, the FDA report said that the leading effects, the leading adverse events, they called them, were reported by children, were fatigue, headache, trouble sleeping, drowsiness, jaw clenching, and increased appetite. So those were the leading adverse events. I did a little more research into the product safety information on this. And to your point, what it's doing, I just like you and Peter, who are the doctors and the scientists on this. Then this is the complete list of what it's doing. In addition to the ones I mentioned, lightheadedness, nightmares, tooth pain, rapid heartbeat, poor appetite, stomach ache, nausea, vomiting, frequent urination, constipation, itching, skin rash, and tingling skin. So to say that this is sending therapeutic signals with all those god-awful of adverse events happening to kids, to me, on the face of it, just seems like the worst kind of dishonesty and a tragic thing that they're doing to kids' brains, Ken and Peter.
Well, there's no reason to think that those random signals would be therapeutic in any way. That's a total fantasy. If you say to put the word therapeutic on those things, makes no sense at all.
Well, what about those effects that are happening then? They're real.
That's correct. And for example, you mentioned jaw clenching. One of the functions of the trigeminal nerve is to control the muscles in the jaw. You use those when you chew. So if you stimulate that nerve, it could easily cause jaw clenching.
And nightmares, nausea.
I mean, it's really amazing to think about that impulses are being sent backward up a nerve, which is mainly sending down impulses, creating what sort? And by impulses, I mean depolarization. Nerve signals are going up the wrong way therapeutically. I'm laughing because it makes me angry and anxious, and I don't know what else to do with those feelings on television. It's so bizarre. And remember, this is the devices division of the FDA saying this, not the drug company's fake false ads. This is the false ads of the FDA for the drug. And of course, this is the same devices division as Ken Castleman and I both know, that never approved ECT or disproved it and never tested it for decades. They just let these men, mostly men and some women, jack up the ECT machines from the 80 or 120 milliamps needed to do a convulsion in the old days, when it was much safer, up to a required 800 to 900 milliamps, you know, 10 times the amount of electricity needed to cause a convulsion. So they're obviously burning the brain, hitting the brain as hard as they can with electricity. And none of this was ever monitored in any way by the FDA. And then after the suit that both Dr. Kesselman and I were involved in, within days, they came to the rescue of the manufacturers. And for the first time, out of the blue, practically, suddenly, really a rescue, approved FDA-approved ECT for depression that's resistant to treatment. And, I mean, that's all depression is resistant to treatment, because the treatments don't work. And so you go to a doctor whose treatments really don't work, which is a doctor who likes ECT, because if he likes ECT, he certainly doesn't know how to help people. So you go to a doctor who's gotten in on ECT in some way, he does it, or he's got a buddy who does it, and then make a lot of money from ECT. And it's called treatment resistant automatically. And now that's all approved by the FDA. And they did it instantly to come to the support of electroshock. And if we get a chance toward the end, maybe I'll talk about what I think are some of the government relationships between the devices group at the FDA and some of the agencies. But Michael, I'm sure you've got more you'd like to say about the Monarch, and I'd like to hear more from Kenneth too.
Well, of course, we're talking about the Monarch that was designed for children. And so ECT, some children have received ECT over the years, but Peter, you were very strong and eloquent in past conversations we've had about what this does to children, to their actual developing brain, or what it could be. Like you were saying, Ken, there's no known effects. In fact, the product safety information I saw, it says, because the study only covered 4 weeks, that it says after 4 weeks, because the mechanism is unknown, the effects are unknown, after 4 weeks, please consult with your prescribing physician. So this is kind of like an open-ended experiment on kids developing brains, which what you were saying earlier, Peter, our lack of knowledge and understanding of the brain with all our science and everything else, one of the most high risk things to do. You know, we hear about it from drugs and all the prohibitions to affect children's brains. This is affecting children's brains. That's just the thing that got me mobilized about this. You know, I worked with kids for decades, and to see some of them have these immediate effects to these strong psychiatric drugs that came online. There's no doubt that this, you know, if you have a laundry list of side effects, 20 of them, those effects are happening because it's doing something to the brain, right? So this is a developing brain that's being hurt.
And Michael, on that point, if you were to do that to an adult, the brain is already pretty much formed, and it might adapt to some extent to this onslaught of random noise. But if you have a developing brain, the connections in the brain are still being formed, and new cells are growing. So it would probably affect those as well. So you might have a person who grows up with their brain totally different than it might have been if they had not received this treatment.
Yeah. Well, you know, conceivably, wow, this just occurred to me. Conceivably, they'll end up needing to wear the thing with the noise in it for the rest of their lives because their brains have adapted to the noise, just like they adapt to drugs. Like kids who get Ritalin end up turning to cocaine later on and become cocaine addicts. My goodness. They could end up needing this machine because they grew up with it. They were nurtured by the machine. That's not far-fetched, is it?
No, it's not.
Oh, that makes me feel ill. I hadn't thought of that possibility before. It reminds me of some of the kids in my practice who just love music, and they've got their headphones on all the time, and a few of them have said to me over the years, you know, Dr. Bregan, I don't know how you can walk around without having music in your ears. And I think that's okay, you know, the person can adapt around that and function in most settings listening to music in the background. But what if what you need is the noise of this thing, which is going to make you sicker and sicker?
And I think it reinforces what you talked about before, Peter. That whole kind of sense of self of the young child. I mean, even these children who were put through this so-called research out of UCLA, shame on UCLA, but we know about them. But their sense of self to be like told, and I know they were told, we're doing this to help cure your brain. So that the message is there's something wrong with you, right? There's something wrong with your brain. Right. This may help. We're doing this to help you. Then they have the other group, that what they called in the study the sham group, who was getting the thing without the current, who also were, you know, told you have something wrong with your brain. So I think that whole thing around confidence and self-esteem and self-image, whether they kind of adapt to it by saying, you know, this is something I need for the rest of my life, that kind of learned helplessness, or whether it's just a devastating kind of impact on how they feel about themselves. You really said that in a touching way last time we talked, Peter. You know, the child who, you know, the little child who's, their internal dialogue about this is, I have something wrong with my brain. My friends, a lot of them, they don't, but I'm at home at night with this on my head every night. I think that's the other thing, you know, as a child therapist, always looking at how kids are traumatized. I mean, this is a traumatic thing to happen to a child, in my view.
Without the child even knowing it, it's transforming their identity. It's pushing them toward machinehood, toward thinking of themselves as a biochemical a mechanism rather than as a person with free will, responsibility, the ability to grow, ability to overcome things. It's really devastating. And Michael, you've worked with children who have been you know, very disturbed. You've worked with children who are psychotic. So have I, actually. Of course, I work with them all the time. But you've got huge experience there. And I'd love to hear you talk about what is a psychotic child, a child who thinks he's something other than a person already, who thinks he's a machine controlled by waves from outer space or thinks he's whatever, you know? I mean, psychotic children get all kinds of ideas, thinks he's from another planet, from another world. That's very common in children who are very disturbed. What's he going to think when the docs now try this on them? Because you reminded me right away when we talked about this, boy, this is going to get into the state facilities. This is going to get everywhere. And it's going to get on the most disturbed kids. You talk about your experience. What's a disturbed child going to experience?
I think that's a very important question. First of all, I'll just say, you know, my experience working in that public system where all these new treatments get operationalized is they first come in and they're kind of pilots and they're new. And then pretty soon it gets more and more pervasive. And then pretty soon it's the new standard of care. It's a best practice. And so I do believe that, you know, I don't know how long it'll take. We mentioned last time this company, NeuroSigma, that developed this, has already established a partnership to expand this nationwide with Quick Care Pharmacy. You know, talk about just the most basic.
It's ironic. Quick, it's a real quick care for you, kid. Yeah. We all week, so we have no idea what the quick care is going to do. But
they have this program with Quick Care Pharmacy where you can go down and sign up and get the device. But the other thing you were mentioning about children who are really struggling, who are kind of at the far end of the spectrum of, in terms of trauma. And like I said, I worked for that county where it was very stressful, all the social conditions. To add this on, I mean, I believe it more than just hurts the child's sense of self. It can really contribute to this, you know, I hope the audience remembers George Orwell, that kind of Orwellian view of themselves and the world. I mean, it's like we're sitting here talking today, basically refuting the false claims of the companies and the FDA. So the whole thing around what is real, you know, is do I really have a brain disease? Are these things that I'm imagining real? Well, maybe, you know, all these new advances, like, you know, we've done a show on Canada was on the Abilify, the antipsychotic meds that they've placed a microchip now in the Abilify to track the compliance with that. You take the Abilify chip, you have a little electrical unit on your hip here. When it has a silicon chip in there, when it hits the acid in your stomach, it sends off a signal through a Bluetooth that goes to the person who's monitoring you 20 miles away. So there's this, the kids are just kind of in this world. This, to me, is kind of a nether world of, you know, people are monitoring me. You're not paranoid, right? They are monitoring, you know, and, right.
And you take a drug like Abilify, which is the most torturous, perhaps, of all the drugs, because it has very high rates of akathisia, which is a terrible internal torture that makes you want to move about. It's associated with causing and worsening psychosis, with suicide, with violence. A lot of the adult cases of violence I see have an element of akathisia that's been tormenting and driving the person crazy. And then you give him a pill which monitors whether he's taking it or not, so he can't stop taking it or they'll come get him. Or, we haven't mentioned this, especially with Abilify and the antipsychotics, he's put on outpatient involuntary commitment. That is, he's committed by the state, must take his drugs, and the state will come and visit him. And if he's not taking his drugs, if they have any evidence for that, or he's getting worse, they'll just bring him right back in without having to even go through the judicial system because he's already committed. Is that an accurate description, Michael, of this outpatient stuff we've had for decades?
I think it's close, yeah, especially, you know, in New York, what was it? Well, in California, it's Laura's Law. And again,
I think, was it Jessica's?
I'm sorry, I can't remember what it was in New York, but it's been like a again, as you and I know, a lot of these things happen out of kind of the unholy alliance of NAMI, the National Alliance of the Mentally Ill, the pharma companies, and neuropsychiatry. In here in California, I mean, the Bay Area, they said, you know, that'll never happen here. It'll never happen in San Francisco, Berkeley, you know, Marin County, Santa Cruz. Well, every one of those governmental bodies that, you know, fund these things have been worn down by NAMI. So to where now it's all of the counties have the court ordered in-home treatment. So yeah, when you accompany that with these advances, so-called advances that are so bizarre, and I just wonder, you know, if things are coming to all of our minds, Ken and Peter, this study that was so short-lived with no replication, there was, you know, we always look at, you know, with Abilify and these different meds, the withdrawal, and no one is better at it than you, Peter, talking about how people suffer and can hardly withdraw and they have all these effects. What's going to be the withdrawal after a child's been on this brain device, you know, for some time? That's another huge question, right? I mean, what we're talking about them taking it indefinitely, but what's going to happen when they stop taking it? What do you think, Ken?
Well, let me try to address it. Yeah. I mean, every intrusion into the brain is met by the brain with a countermeasure. Doesn't matter if it's a splinter blasted into your brain or whether it's a psychosurgery where your brain's cut or any one of the psychiatric drugs. But I don't know that we've looked at all at withdrawal from chronic psychiatric stimulation. We know that and this is where Ken, I think, could pick up on, we know that the brain is going to reconform itself. It is going to change itself in response to these tiny sledgehammer little pulses that are sending reverse, in most cases, up the nerves, chaotic messages. The brain's going to try to impose some order on that. It isn't going to do what this lousy devices division at the FDA says. It's not going to be therapeutic. The brain's going to view it as a terrible intrusion and do everything it can during growth and development. This is going to start with the youngest possible children. I mean, they allowed testing on 7-year-olds, so that's the age, you know, but it could be, they'll give it to anybody. It's just like I do with the drugs. They give the drugs to infants. So there's going to be a reconfiguration of the brain in some fashion to deal with the chaos. And Ken, you got any wild prediction on what that might look like if you then withdraw the stimulus and the brain is reconfigured?
Well, first off, it's going to be a big surprise to the brain, particularly, say, when you're asleep, you know, like these kids are. The brain is kind of sitting there just monitoring what's going on. And then all of a sudden it gets deluged with these random signals coming in from what it thinks is the face. And so it's got to respond. It's going to do some kind of response, but it will not be a natural response because those are not natural signals that it's receiving. So who knows what type of response the brain will develop to adjust to that. You know, the body responds to insults of all kinds. And most of those responses are healing type responses. If you cut yourself, you know, the cells come in there and they clean up the wound and it starts healing. But what is the brain going to do if it suddenly gets a deluge of random noise coming in from the nerves that serve the face and the front part of the head? So, but what you know is it's going to adapt in some way or another. And the brain, over a period of time, if this was a one-shot deal, it wouldn't be so bad. But this is continuous, like 6 hours every night for months. You know, well, that's the kind of thing that the body in general and the brain in particular will adjust to. It will change itself to accommodate this new strange situation. And nobody is in a position to predict how the brain is going to modify its structure and its function in response to this long-term stimulation with random noise.
Well, you know, we could think of one thing. And all this, folks, you're watching us guys here trying to figure out stuff for the first time ever, right on the show. But if it indeed can produce a stimulation, I'm not sure that stimulating the neurons is going to produce an actual stimulation effect. I think it's very uncertain. But let's suppose it can produce some sort of a stimulation effect. It gets a couple of neurotransmitters more active. We know that the brain is going to try to shut down the effect. The brain is going to try to shut down whatever neurons are stimulated, and it's going to try to jack up whatever neurons are shut down by this. So what we're going to get is a bunch of arrays that are trying to fight the stimulation effect. And I think I should stop using stimulation, the electrical disruption effect. To the extent that the electrical disruption effect is causing something roughly resembling stimulation, God knows what that would mean, then the brain, God knows what that means, is going to fight back and subdue. And the degree to which it's subduing, the brain is going to fight that by jacking it up. And we know this, like Prozac or Abilify or Seroquel, any of the drugs we study, we know the brain has multiple, and fully understood by any means, but multiple ways of trying to compensate for everything that the drug is doing. So if you give somebody Prozac, the brain tries to shut down the stimulation caused, tries to shut down the production of serotonin. So you have Prozac trying to increase serotonin, you have the brain trying to shut it down, the brain then tries to get rid of it faster, the brain then gets rid of its receptors, they die back and says, I'm just not going to respond to all this. And then in addition to that, while that's going on, the dopamine kicks in and tries to compensate for what's happened to serotonin. So you get these messes and multiple changes throughout the brain. And now you're spinning electricity through all this. I think that's going to be, as Ken is suggesting, much more confusing about all this. Ken?
I think you're right about that, because the brain is accustomed to a certain level of neurological activity.
Yeah, that's homeostasis.
Yeah. But then all of a sudden, here comes all these random messages in from the outside, and it elevates the level of activity in the brain. And the brain is going to think, this is not right. And it's going to do whatever it can. We're speculating now as to how the brain's going to respond to this insult. But it's logical to think that it would respond by trying to reduce the level of neurological activity back down to the level that it considers normal, particularly while you're sleeping. And as you say, that requires shutting down brain cells from doing what they're doing.
Let me put in one word, and then I'll sit back again. But we have this old concept going back to Cannon, that great neurophysiologist who many people still kind of read about, because he came upon, he created the fight flight concept of the secretion of adrenaline to increase fight or flight. But what he talked about was homeostasis. The body tries to return to what its natural state is. And the brain will seek homeostasis. And to do that, it will be fighting against the impulses. And when the impulses stop, you'll have a brain that's way out of homeostasis because it's been doing all these things. And the brain may not recover. We know the brain does not recover completely in many cases from traumatic brain injury. We know it doesn't recover from ECT in many, 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 most cases. I mean, I hardly ever met anybody with a so-called full recovery from ECT, and I think many of those people are too harmed to know. So, I mean, we're looking at, now we're also looking at, with a victim of ECT, named Hancock, and she's been listening to my radio show, and she's been putting together a bibliography of what low voltage harm can do. And that's going to pertain to all this. We're just on the edges now of learning what in the world might happen to these people. It's really a travesty. It's really crime. I'm not exaggerating, am I, guys?
No. And, you know, when you talk about homeostasis, which is so linked now, we know, to sleep, right? The brain needs sleep, and the brain needs, there's so much research going on around the importance of sleep and the different sleep cycles and everything. I've specialized for about the last 40 years working with folks in extreme state psychosis, and sleep is always a huge marker in terms of someone going in to their first or 10th episode of these extreme states. The disruption of sleep, the disruption of dreams, it's almost always a factor. So when I hear children's brain being bombarded this way every night, I can't imagine that it's not disrupting their sleep patterns, their sleep cycles, that whole kind of natural healing that we know now from current research that the brain is undergoing during sleep. They have no measurements. How is this monarch affecting deep sleep? How it's affecting REM sleep? There's none of that. None of that science has been done. But I believe anything that interrupts and damages that natural healing of sleep sets someone up for real problems psychologically.
They do say, and you discovered this, Michael, that it does cause insomnia. I mean, that just sounds so innocent, but that's a sign of disruption of the normal patterns. Ken Castleman, I just had a thought. Ken, would you tell? I mean, you're very important here, and people aren't familiar with you from my audience. Tell a little bit about yourself, so folks know where you're coming from as an expert on electrical injury. Your papers, your testimony, and stuff.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I was educated as a biomedical engineer, and that's a type of engineer that works in the area of biology and medicine. And in my career, I've been on the faculty at Caltech and at the University of Texas, and I have worked on research projects in the area of genetics and cardiology and muscle physiology. And interfaced with a variety of medical problems that have engineering solutions. So what biomedical engineers do is bring the knowledge of modern engineering technology to bear on understanding and solving the problems in medicine. I worked for NASA for 15 years at the Jet Propulsion Laboratory. And after I left NASA, you remember we had the two shuttle accidents, Challenger and Columbia. NASA called me back in both cases to come back and analyze the launch films to help figure out exactly what caused those two accidents. And over the years, I've been able to participate in actually a large number of medical research projects. I've served on a study section at the National Institutes of Health where we reviewed grant applications to determine which ones get funded and which ones don't. So I learned a lot about what it takes to do real science as compared to what you read in these psychiatry journals. And I've taught and basically had a wide exposure to medical problems from an engineering point of view. So when I look at something like ECT or this nerve stimulation, I know what electricity is and I know what electricity does to human tissue. And so I approach it more from that direction than you guys have the ability to look at it from the patient's point of view and the treatment point of view and that kind of thing. I look at it as what are these volts and amps actually doing to this human tissue?
Yeah.
Well, now we get into something much more subtle, which is what are these low voltages doing when they're applied for hours and hours to a growing brain, changing its EEG pattern, we know that.
Yeah. I mean,
they talk about, they say such stupid things like it's modulating the EEG, the brain waves. Brain waves are a very gross measurement. I mean, you could have a hit in the head and it wouldn't change your brain waves. You can have all kinds of things happen to you without changing your brain waves. It takes something like ECT, shock treatment, to change brain waves. And here is this thing that a little bit dribble, chaos in the brain. And changing brain waves. I mean, it's including afterward. They don't tell us how long because they don't want to know or see or tell us. But that's a powerful effect when you change something as gross as the brain waves.
Right. And I think there's an analogy to what this type of, they call it low voltage, and the voltage is lower.
We're finishing up. Make a quick statement again. Ken Castleman and Michael, thank you so much, as always, Michael Cornwall, for being on the show. But finish up, Ken.
Yeah, just this would be like, say you had a telephone, an old landline telephone, not a cell phone, and you know about wiretapping. Somebody can climb up a telephone pole and connect to your wires, and then he can not only listen into your call, but he can make calls from your number. He could call call up all your friends and they think it was you. And to use something like this for ADHD would be like going to the phone company and saying, my friends don't like me very much, what can you do? And the phone company says, well, we can send a guy off the telephone pole and he can connect a radio to your phone lines and tune it to a rock station. And all your friends, when they call you up, they'll hear rock music. And not only that, it will call your friends for you and play rock music for them. And you say, okay, how does that help? Well, we think it helps. We did a short study on a few people for a short period of time. And we used some evaluative techniques. And we think it helps. And besides that, the money is good.
Yeah. That's it, Ken Castleman, Michael Cornwall. God bless you, and thank you for being on the Dr. Peter Brecken Hour.
Thank you both. Thank you.